The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Women's World Cup, England through to the knockout stages, while it's an uphill struggle now for Scotland. Australia come back from two goals behind to beat Brazil, while all of the rest of the big guns win pretty easily. Argentina's men are beaten by Colombia in the Copa America. Premier League news, Maurizio Sarri's made the step up from Chelsea to Juventus, while Frank Lampard will get the job just after we finish recording. And Paul Pogba wants a new challenge after achieving all he possibly could have done at Manchester United. We'll do all that, take your questions, and we have some huge Carabao news, all on today's Guardian Football Weekly. Here's a question from Dan. Was the ghost last saw Barry's ghostly apparition coming back to haunt him for killing him in order to take his place on the pod as Max's resident foreign Irish-sounding sidekick?
I mean, if...
Have you killed Barry?
No, and if anything, if someone had killed Barry, I would think that whoever is in Barry's chair would be in far more trouble than I would be.
Do you think so? The boss, Marcus Christensen, have you killed Barry?
No, not at all.
Okay. Not just even a little bit.
No, not a tiny amount. Yeah.
Debut for Tim Stillman, women's football and South American football expert. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
From fear of the penalty kick, hearing at Stilberto on Football Weekly will be weird, like Ian Beale turning up in Coronation Street. Have you got permission from the many other podcasts you may or may not do?
The wonderful thing about freelancing is that you can be a massive mercenary. So today I'm kissing the Football Weekly badge in front of the fans, and tomorrow, well, we'll see what tomorrow brings.
Okay. Well, maybe by tomorrow you'll be like Paul Pogba going, look, I've done everything I possibly could for this podcast. Let's start with the best game of the tournament so far, probably. Australia coming back from two goals down to beat Brazil 3-2. Let's talk to friend of the pod, Kieran Pender, who was at the game. Kieran, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. You're up a mountain.
Yeah, I'm in Grenoble ahead of Australia-Jamaica, and Grenoble's sort of on the foothills of the Alps or all around it. Great view from the stadium, I must say, and I thought I'd go for a bit of a stroll before the game tomorrow.
Did Australia make hard work of this, or is this a great comeback? How are you perceiving this game?
It was a fantastic comeback, and I think when you put it in the broader context, that does help as well to really understand how significant this comeback was. So the Matildas have had their backs against the wall. They've had the coaching turmoil that's beset them for the last 3 or 4 months and refuses to go away. Then they lost the warm-up game in Holland to the Netherlands 3-0. Then they lost unexpectedly to the Italians. To be 2-0 down on the cusp of half time, and to turn that around and beat Brazil, you know, not currently one of the best teams in the world, but historically one of the best teams in the world, I think really puts in context what a remarkable turnaround that was.
Who shone for Australia in the second half?
I think Sam Kerr, the captain, shone as a talisman, although didn't necessarily make an impact on the score sheet. And then Chloe Legazzo was the player of the game. She scored one of the goals, was involved in the first, scored the second. She's really been a shining star of the tournament for the team. And as they look to the Jamaica game, which they really need to score a number of goals to have any hope of finishing top of the group, they'll be hoping that Kerr and Legazzo and some of the other attacking-minded players will shine again.
Did Sam Kerr try and claim that second goal? I mean, it was a bit like Harry Kane trying to claim that goal, except she was a mile away from it.
Yes, she said afterwards she didn't claim it, but it did look as if, and to be honest, I was doing the live blog for The Guardian live from the stadium, and I thought she'd scored. So I can't blame her for claiming it.
A lot's made about VAR and whether you know what's happening in the stadium or whether you don't. Were you confused when they were trying to debate whether that was an offside goal for the third? I mean, I was ranting about it before we came on air that goal was given, because there is no way that she's not interfering with play. But I wonder if you knew what was going on.
I had no idea. And I think I admitted on the live blog, I think I said, "Dear reader, I have no idea what's going on." And I think that's the real challenge with VAR, isn't it? That if you're in the stadium, it really disrupts the atmosphere, particularly if you're trying to follow along for journalistic purposes. I agree, as an Australian, obviously, I was quite happy for that goal to be given. But I did think, and I appreciate the letter of the law and the exact rule and whether that was interference or not is contested. But to say that the players for Brazil didn't defend in a certain way or didn't address that ball knowing that she was behind and that didn't change their reaction, I think is absurd.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, it's a long free kick over the top. Monica goes for the ball because Sam Kerr is behind her, heads it into her own net. I mean, Lars, is that just bad refereeing?
I mean, I kind of agree with you for once, Max.
I don't
understand how you can possibly argue that the player isn't affecting the behaviour of the defenders there.
I think the main point at the moment is that basically the rules haven't really adjusted for VAR yet. And so a lot of these kind of incidents where, you know, in the past, maybe you let them go or maybe an offside flag goes up and nobody really complains. But when you kind of isolate moments like that, and it causes, I think, maybe a bit of overthinking of these kind of incidents. And, because there seem to be contradictory rules, like you need to touch the ball to be flagged offside. But then there's the whole interfering point. And I think we've perhaps just made a bit of a mess of the offside rule, and it needs addressing.
So it's not necessarily totally the referee's fault. I'm looking at the referee going, why? How on earth have you've had the benefit of a replay, you're looking at a TV, and how could you possibly think that Sam Kerr is not interfering there?
It reminded me a bit, do you remember a goal Raheem Sterling scored at the end of last season, I think at home to Watford, where something really similar happened? There was this kind of, he was miles offside, but there was this kind of, but he didn't touch the ball, so how much is he interfering? And the referee kind of discussed it with the assistant for ages. And I think when you really, really ruminate on these decisions, you can overthink them. And I kind of think that's what's going on here.
I mean, I was slightly annoyed that the Chile offside goal wasn't given, where everyone completely missed it against the US. But the linesman, the referee's assistant raised their flag and it was the right thing to do. But it would have been very funny if they had given that goal. Kieran, can Australia, you know, how much confidence can they gain from this? Because they're sort of one of the sort of favoured teams, aren't they? And they haven't looked particularly good yet.
I think this win against Brazil will give them a huge boost. As I said, backs against the wall, very much so. Both up to the tournament in those early games, the pre-tournament friendly, and then the Italy loss. That win against Brazil, and then they've got Jamaica tomorrow, who you'd think they'll beat without much challenge. As I said, they need to score a lot of goals there to have finishing first. I think a big win against Jamaica, potentially sort of along similar lines to the US win against Thailand, could then see them moving into the next round, possibly against Norway or the third place team for a number of the groups, the best third place team. You know, that will give them a fairly strong run into the quarters and the semis. The challenge will come when they face, you know, a world-class team. Brazil are no longer one of the best teams in the world. I mean, they still have those star players, Marta, etc. Flamengo, who's been, you know, this is a seventh World Cup, but they are now all best and don't quite have the legs. So the test for Australia will be against a team like England or France or the US. I think Australia aren't quite at that level, but they have the players with the talent that they could go toe-to-toe with in England. Like players like Sam Kerr, she hasn't had the best tournament so far, but it could be at the quarterfinal or semi-final stage against a team like England or France or the United States, where a player like Sam Kerr comes alive and drags this Australian team that have the quality, but perhaps not the full depth of quality that those other teams have. And someone like Sam Kerr might drag Australia into the final and possibly beyond.
And just finally, Kieran, Sam Kerr after the game, her direct quote was, "Suck on that one."
An interesting quote. She was very fired up when I spoke to her after the match. There's been a lot of criticism of the team following the Dutch loss and the Italy loss. And there's been a lot of speculation that continues of the coaching situation. The Australian head coach was sacked not long before the tournament, and the speculation over that has sort of continued. So I think the way it was interpreted post-match was that it was those criticisms, and it was... you know, she said, "We don't listen to the haters, you know, suck on that." She then, after the match, retweeted some fairly nasty homophobic criticism to her on social media. So it's I think her comments have taken on an added element with that. And, you know, obviously there's absolutely no place for that in the game. And you know, rightly she just rejected that sort of criticism. I think, you know, people have a right to criticise their national and role of the journalist to ask tough questions. So I think the challenge is you know, when you start conflating, you know, homophobic comments, which, as I said, have no place, with legitimate criticism about a team that lost twice in a row, that causes problems. But I think, you know, her outspoken nature, I think she's won a lot more fans by being so authentic. And I expect if Australia progressed in the tournament, she'll continue to speak her mind.
Kieran, thanks so much for your time. Enjoy your hike.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Kieran Pender there, Guardian's man out watching Australia. Interesting on this game, Marta, right? Look, she actually scored a pen, set up the second brilliantly, Tim, but six-time FIFA World Player of the Year, hasn't won a match since last July. Prior to this World Cup, Brazil had lost their last six games in a row, and her club side, bottom of the NWSL, Orlando Pride, after nine games, also without a win since July.
Yeah, absolutely. And Brazil kind of came into this tournament in real disarray. Marta herself has been carrying a thigh injury, so she's not really fit. She was only able to play 45 minutes. Personally, I'm delighted for her that she got that penalty. She's got that, you know, goal in the World Cup, and actually something really nice she did. You'll notice in the celebration, she pointed to her boot. She refused boot sponsorship deals for this World Cup, and she's wearing the symbol of gender equality on her boot instead. So that's why she pointed to the boot. So again, I'm really delighted she got to make that gesture, because, you know, while we're covering the Women's World Cup and things like that, the point she's making is that the offers she's getting for boot sponsorship are just far below what a male athlete could expect.
England are through to the knockout stages, Marcus. It's coming home.
Yes, again.
I know, I can't wait. another
last
World
summer, exactly. And earlier this summer, yeah. It's keep coming home. Yes, good. No, I was impressed by them. It was a difficult game against Argentina on Friday night. Argentina were tough. They're defensively very, very solid. And there was lots of incidents off the ball and so on that the England players didn't, well, they did react a little bit, but not enough to get sent off and so on. And for Jodie Taylor to get a goal is apparently 14 months since he scored for England. And she's such an important player, like Phil Neville said afterwards as well. So I think you can't do more than get two wins from the first two games, and they're in a good position.
And actually, this score was kept down because Argentina's defence, Marcus, was pretty stoic, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, they were good. And like I said, the goalkeeping performance as well. But I think overall, it's been a good World Cup. Obviously, we had the USA-Thailand result, which kind of skewed everything. I think the African teams have done really well. The South American teams as well. The Asian teams maybe have not done as well, but it's overall as a standard. There's been one-sided games, but it's a great improvement, and it's only going to go in that direction as national FAs get bigger budgets and, like you say, full-time goal coaching and so on. So, no, it's been good. Yeah.
Lars, how impressed have you been with England? What's your sort of general view of their two performances so far?
See, I'm still... Yeah, Argentina defended well, and obviously they held Japan, which is not an easy thing to do. So they are. It isn't easy to play against the team that sits back the way they do. I still think England. It's interesting. I think they look so much more comfortable when they have space to run into. There's been a lot of emphasis on being more confident with the ball and passing it around better. But I still think whenever the game opens up a little bit, which was not very often against Argentina, obviously because they sat back, but they have quite a lot of players who are very strong runners with the ball, and you just look like they are much more comfortable when they have spaces. Now, the good news is, having gotten 6 points from games against Scotland and Argentina, you're more likely to have those sort of games going forward when you're facing better opponents. So, I mean, the fact that they still, to my eyes, they don't look that convincing than when they're passing the ball around and trying to break down a defensive opponent. But that doesn't have to be a problem in the tournament going forward.
So does that mean it's kind of quite hard for us to read who is having, you know, who, because you it's the untrained eye. You look at US winning 13-0 and you know, France swatting someone aside, and you think, well, they're clearly the best teams. But actually, breaking a team down who are defending, so it's a different skill, right? When you come up against teams who are both trying to win.
Yeah, absolutely. I still think England look quite disjointed. They have done, I think, for the entirety of Phil Neville's reign. I still don't think he knows what his best 11 is at the moment. They lack a bit of a passer, perhaps, in midfield for these games to kind of unlock opponents. But, I mean, I've not been that impressed, to be honest. But I'd say about England compared to, say, France and the USA, they don't quite have that clutch player. They don't have an Alex Morgan. They don't have, like, a Wendy Renard or someone like that. They have lots of very good players, but not that one player that you think can win a game on her own.
And can Lucy Bronze or Nikita Paris sort of step up
to that role?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, Luce is a right back, so, you know, she can have great influence on a game, but perhaps not win it on her own. Nikita Paris is possibly the closest at the moment, but even she, I don't think looks quite at home in this England team.
And do you think, like, missing Jordan Nobbs, that's an absolute key, right?
Huge, absolutely huge. Particularly, like I said, they lack kind of a bit of creativity in midfield anyway, and Jordan's one of the best midfielders in the world. Any team would miss her.
Yeah, so going forward, they'll be playing stronger opponents. So, like, Paris in bronze and Frank Kirby even will have, like, they'll have space to run into, and I think that suits their game better. But on the other side, they haven't really been tested defensively yet in any sort of significant way. So that's another thing that'll be really interesting in the Japan game, to see how they hold up in that side of it.
So Japan, they play next. Japan beat Scotland 2-1. Problem again, too, for Scotland, that they don't really start until they're 2-0 down.
Yeah, so they've played two superior teams and they've kind of come close, but I don't think the 2-1 scorelines have kind of told the story of the games yet. I think they've been dominated for the majority of those games. And, you know, Scotland have some really, really good players. Most of them play in the WSL. And, you know, Kim Little, who I watch a lot of, is, you know, listen to anyone who played in America with her talk about her. They talk about her as one of the top kind of three midfielders in the world. And we haven't really seen much from Kim. And I think against Argentina, I'm not sure they're a team that's really built to go and play another team like that. I was expecting more from them in these first two games.
The opening goal for Japan, Mana Iwabuchi, decent strike, but gone right in the middle of the goal. You have to do better than that.
Yeah, but also if you're a goalkeeper, you're a bit cross with the defender for turning her back there. I mean, that wasn't
true.
You should stand up there and try to block it, surely. Hmm. I mean, as a person who's not wild about getting a ball to the face at a tremendous velocity, but, like, if you're a centre half at a World Cup, that is kind of part of your remit.
And that was quite out of character for Jen Beattie, actually. And I just wonder if she was worried about the handball rule here a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, that's possible.
There was a moment in that where Scotland should have had a penalty for a handball. Not a penalty I would like to be given.
Yeah, that was odd. I agree. Like, under the new handball laws, that looked a lot like it should have been, though I'm perfectly happy it wasn't. It's just, I guess, the consistency thing will get annoying then.
Yeah, and they've had a penalty given, like, a very similar penalty given against them in the England game for something very similar.
So how can that possibly not be given? I'm glad it wasn't. How can it possibly not? I mean, it's ludicrous.
Well, officials make the decisions they make, you know, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no more science to it. Like, but I think the way we talk about VAR is a little bit annoying sometimes. What we have to remember is it's just another set of eyes looking at it on the replay. I mean, and they will also make decisions we disagree with. That's just going to be a thing that happens.
Netherlands 3, Cameroon 1. Two goals for Vivian Miedema. And she, I think, one of the absolute stars of this tournament, Marcus. I don't know how much you've seen of her. And I don't know if I made the comparison to her. She seems sort of like Harry Kane to me. Sort of plays a similar way, the way she took that second goal. Yeah. Very reminiscent.
And I mean, Tim watches a lot more on club level and so on, but she is one of the kind of outstanding performers and one of those you watch and you think, wow, yeah, she will always score pretty much. And although the Dutch are, I'm not quite sure about them yet in this tournament, and there are moments of brilliance and good play and so on, but are they really going past the quarterfinals at this stage?
Yeah, because I think a layer of expectation has been created because they won the Euros. But to be honest, they weren't the best team in Europe. They were the best of a fairly average bunch of that tournament, and they were on home soil. Miedema is their clutch player. You know, talking about England lacking a clutch player, that's Vivian Miedema all over. And I think the Harry Kane comparison's an interesting one. I mean, her idol growing up, she's a Feyenoord fan, so Robin van Persie is her absolute idol, and you can see van Persie's game in her. Yeah. But the Kane comparison's a good one as well, because she started as a number 10 and subsequently became a number 9, and you can see that in her game. She's got all of the technical skills, but she's just ruthless in front of goal.
All-time top scorer for the Netherlands women's national team at the age of just 22. Top scorer in the WSL last year. And it was a decent game, Lars. Both sides trying to win. And an issue I've had is there aren't enough games where both sides are trying to win.
No, but they're an intriguing game team for the neutral, the Dutch, because you can see they've got a lot of quality attacking, not just her, but also like Shanice van Zanten is a good player, and Dendonker is a good player. So, but they don't, they look a bit ropey at the back, and also they don't look like the offensive sort of coordination is that great either. So you do fare for them a little bit when they come up against strong opposition. I think the game against Canada will be very interesting, actually, because Canada are very stubborn defensively. But just for the neutral, they're great. They're a good team to watch in that regard.
We spent a lot of Thursday's pod talking about follow throughs. Lars, there was a tremendous one.
Do you agree that that was a foul?
Well, it's a player called Mbelek who basically kicks someone in the face after
pretty much
booting the ball.
Magnificently, on the BBC commentary, there was someone making the point that she had gotten the ball first, which is like, come on, guys.
it's totally different to the other one that got me very upset. You know, Norway conceded that penalty to France. It was very different. And I stand by what I said, even if I'm still wrong.
Studs in knee, okay. Studs in face, not so much.
No, it's all about the follow through, and if it's in sort of a continuous action and the placing of the foot.
Neither
are a foul for me, actually, Brian.
This should have been a red. And this is another one. Like, VAR will not be flawless. They're humans watching replays, and somehow they decided that this wasn't a red card. But I think, you know, if that's not endangering the safety of a player, I don't know.
You're going to tell me now that De Jong should have got sent off, aren't you?
Crazy talk.
And I think the thing about this one as well is, you know, looking at it as an isolated incident, it looks bad because it is bad. But also the temperature of the game at this point was very high. There were lots of fouls going on. It was very niggly, and yeah, I think a little bit of frustration came out there.
Right, that'll do for part one. We'll begin part two with the United States 3-0 win over Chile. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. The US 3, Chile 0. 10 goals fewer than they score. I mean, this is a devastating blow for their form and confidence, I imagine, Lars.
Terrible.
Carly Lloyd's.
But I mean, they stopped before it became politically incorrect to celebrate. So they avoided that whole controversy this time, which I think was good of them.
The first goal, Carly Lloyd, that's a great strike, that
was. Yeah, it was really good. It's a deceptively good goal. It's like every time you watch the replay, you realise that was really, really hard to do.
She's become the first ever player to score in 6 consecutive appearances at the Women's World Cup. She scored 8 across 6 games. How good is she?
She's absolutely terrific, even at the age of 36 now. And before the game, she gave an interview, because she's got this kind of like substitute role at the moment. And she gave this interview where she said, "I've adjusted to this role, but I don't accept it. There is no point in me coming to a World Cup if I accept this role." And it kind of, I think that just tells you a lot about the mentality that runs through this US side. And, you know, you saw with the goals, they were both quality finishes, even if the penalty wasn't such a quality finish at the end.
No, skewed it wide. How different a side with this? I mean, how weakened a side was this?
They made 7 changes. That still doesn't make them that weak, because they were able to start Carly Lloyd, who scored a hat-trick in the last World Cup final, so not that weak, but they've got such a strong squad, and I think the manager, Jill Ellis, just wanted to give some of the young players a bit of a go as well.
And also it was 3-0, but a big part of the reason it was 3-0 was the goalkeeper for Chile, yeah, Christiane Endler, who was fantastic as a German father, I believe, and looked up to Oliver Kahn in a big way when she was younger. She did a tremendous game, absolutely.
There was one save that was a little bit Seaman versus Pesca Solido. Probably not that good as, I mean, that was
that's
an
not where my mind went immediately, Max. But
I understand that. Thank
really,
you, Lars.
It really does.
Like, the thing about the US, Marcus, is they're so much fitter and stronger and quicker that it's almost like I don't even know how technically better they are than the other teams. They just don't give them a minute to breathe.
No, exactly. But we also have to remember that they haven't been up against the toughest opponents yet. So obviously when you watch them at the moment, and these two games are utterly superior, and they are obviously one of the best teams in the world. But I think it's a bit too early to say they are really that far above the kind of other favourites in the tournament.
How strong a favourites do you make, Tim, or do you think it's still open?
I think it's still quite open. They're one of the favourites, definitely. I'd say If you want to win this World Cup, you're probably going to have to beat them. But the way it looks like it's going to go is we're almost certainly going to get a USA-France quarterfinal, and that might really sort things out. But for the US, their next game's against Sweden, and that's a far tougher challenge. Sweden, very rigid defensively. And the last time they played each other at the Olympics, Hope Solo got herself suspended for calling Sweden a bunch of cowards for their defensive display.
Seems quite a harsh suspension, that.
Very strange. Thing to get suspended for, yeah. I think she agrees with you. No, there's been an element of like seal clubbing to what they've been doing so far, and playing in Sweden will be much more interesting. And then I suppose if I've read the bracket correctly, they'll get Spain or China probably in the first knockout, which should also be kind of interesting. I mean, both those have the capacity to make it awkward for them, maybe.
How did we feel about their celebrations in this game? We were happy with how they did it. There's a sort of sarcastic nod to...
I micro-analyse the celebrations because I'm really, really bothered about which team looks the classiest. That's where I extract my joy from football.
The most important thing, I think, especially with men watching the Women's World Cup, is that we have to police the celebrations.
Exactly.
It's all about respect.
Have to tell these women exactly how they're allowed to celebrate so that it suits us.
They meet Sweden next, hammered Thailand 5-1. Did you enjoy it?
Yes, it was, again, a bit one-sided, but it was good for Sweden to get that run out again. The game against Chile in the first round was far more difficult for Sweden. It took a lot longer to break them down, but we got the early goal from Sembrant, and it was fairly easy, but there was actually quite a lot of criticism for the team afterwards for conceding against Thailand. And that's the kind of problem you have if someone before you beat them 13-0 and you only win 5-1. They came in for some criticism, but like someone said on Swedish radio, so Swedish, just win 5-1 and there's criticism anyway. So you can't win in a way, but it's a good start. The game against the USA will tell us a lot. I don't think we can threaten them. I think we're a kind of top 8, top 10 team in this tournament, so can reach the quarters maybe, but maybe not further than that.
Fridolina Rolfo's strike was great, wasn't it? 25 yards, absolute banger, and a lovely header from Lina Hurtig as well. So scoring some nice goals, Lars.
Yeah, Hurtig... Does it mean something? Because in both Norwegian and Danish, Hurtig means quick, which I think for a winger is top nominative determinism.
Yeah, it's a funny one because it's not quite quick, but it's energetic.
Okay.
More, I would say.
Yeah, that kind of works, yeah. Okay. So she's a Hurtig forward.
Yeah.
Is she? Yeah, well, she kind of is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a good mix, and the coach, Gerhardsson, is, like you said, defensively very, very strong. We lack... maybe, possibly like England, a player up front who can just take the game and win. The kind of Madeleine Janogi has come on in both games and been outstanding, plays for PTO, and is that kind of, could become that player, but is not quite yet.
I enjoyed watching Carolina Seger in this game, just in a game where not that much is going on. It's not that exciting. She's a good player to just spend 10 minutes paying attention to what she does. She just doesn't put a foot wrong ever, really. Mm. Just in terms of how she positions her body, always knows what she's going to do with the ball when she gets it. Just her pass average must be incredibly high. As aspiring footballers, just play her cam Carolina Seger for a while. I think there's a lot to learn there.
92% her pass completion.
Yeah, that
was
makes
in this
sense.
Game.
Yeah. Very much in the sort of Michael Carrick school of players who might not always stand out, but just hardly ever does anything wrong, seems to be.
Yeah, and it's great because they're mixed, and then we've got Kosovar Aslani a bit further up the pitch, who is also a joy to watch, but obviously a lot more mistakes because she tries so many different things. But to have those in the team is a very good start.
Tim, do you have all the... pass completion rates of every player committed to memory? That's quite extraordinary.
No, do you know what? Honestly, this is the only one because I was talking about it last night, so I looked it up. So yeah,
you mentioned the Thailand goal. It was a lovely moment. Captain Kanjana Sung Nguyen in the last minute, emotional scenes. One of the officials on the sidelines in tears. A tweet from Samantha Lewis saying the woman in the white jacket is the main benefactor of Thailand's national team, also employs many of the players back home. She's called Nualfan Lamsam. The coach afterwards saying, "It meant so much. It meant that all of our preparation paid off. This one goal made us laugh, made us smile, and made us happy." That will mean a lot to them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of difficult to talk about this kind of moment without, you know, sounding or feeling a bit patronising. Yeah. But there's been a lot of, I think, fairly negative focus on Thailand after the USA game. But I think the light that should be shone here really is Thailand are ranked 34th in the FIFA Women's World Rankings. That puts them above Croatia, Argentina, Nigeria, Slovakia. You know, these kind of countries who've surely got far more resources to put into a women's team, and Thailand are better than all of them. So why is that? And I think that's really the story that should come out from Thailand's participation.
Off the pitch, sad news about a statue of Neela Fischer being vandalised, Marcus.
Yes, it was very disappointing. Perhaps not surprising. It's a general kind of world state of affairs now, isn't it? You go out and so there were four statues of Swedish national team players put up before the World Cup, and Neela Fischer was vandalised and thrown in a nearby river, and the photos were quite sad and so on. I think it's a pathetic thing to do. Cowardly thing, to borrow Hope Solo's words, and so on. And it's not surprising. It's Fischer. She's outspoken. She's in the gay relationship, and so on. But it's and that makes it even worse during a World Cup that someone thinks is a good idea to do that. But they were very classy in the response. They just said it's a terrible thing to happen, but they will redo the statue. And they said we don't want to give any more kind of publicity to these people who did it. There are always going to be idiots around. Sadly, they attacked that statue, but hopefully the way they've been so classy and the raising the profile of the game and carry on doing that will lead to somewhere along the line a future where that won't happen.
Canada 2, New Zealand 0. How exciting a game was this, Tim?
Not very, to be honest with you. And to be honest, Canada's games rarely are. If you look up their scores, it looks a bit like binary code.
It's Tony Pulis, the manager.
It's very 2-0, 1-0 kind of thing. I think they've only conceded one goal in their last 10 games or something like that. Obviously, this was a very different challenge for them because, New Zealand didn't offer much attacking threat. But Canada, a bit like Sweden, actually, they're one of those teams. They're not dreadfully exciting to watch all the time, but nobody will want to draw them in the next round because you have to work so, so hard to get past that defence.
Jamaica 0, Italy 5. Cristiano Girelli scoring a hat-trick, the first a retaken penalty after Sydney Schneider moved off her line. I accept it, Lars. I felt sorry for her, but I accept
it. Yeah, me too, because she was so good in the first game against Brazil, and then you thought she'd started this by saving a penalty.
And when she saved the penalty, it was a good penalty save. But it was a good save, but it was also absolutely, classic. Everyone's trying to celebrate with her, and she is saying, go and do your job. That sort of instant Peter Schmeichel, I'm so angry I've saved a penalty, and I'm angry with everyone around me.
Yeah, presumably even angrier for a VAR to rear its pedantic head. Yeah. No, but I guess, that could be something that'll happen with VAR, is that that rule will actually be enforced, because that it's been almost farcical over the years, the extent to which some goalkeepers have been allowed to go early.
Two goals for Aurora Gali, and the first one was a glorious finish. 25-yard strike. The second I liked even more because I'm a huge fan of players rounding the keeper, and when they can side foot it in, they just absolutely belt it. where do Italy stand? I mean, I expected Australia to beat them in the first game, so I was surprised at that. Should we be surprised at this result?
Not really, actually. They came in very, very quietly because all of the focus in this group was about Australia and Brazil. But Italy kind of very quietly been putting a really good team together. They've got a really, really top-class winger, Bonanseo, who plays for Juventus. And they really came in under the radar, which I think suits them. And again, I'm not sure they can get much further than the round of 16, depending on who they draw. But they're another team that I don't think whoever they draw, will not be happy, I think, to get Italy.
And China beat South Africa 1-0. Li Ying with a clever volley, questionable positioning from the goalkeeper. But going into the final group games then, France, Germany, Italy, England, Japan, the Netherlands, the US and Sweden have qualified. for the round of 16. Scotland need to beat Argentina on Wednesday to have a chance of ending as one of the four best third-place teams. Their big rivals for that are Cameroon and Chile, who both also have 0 points, but worse goal differences. Thailand, despite having a goal difference of minus 17 after two games, could still get to the knockout stages if they beat Chile and other games go their way. Right, for the Women's World Cup, the Copa America started over the weekend. Tim, you're a South American football writer as well. Busy. You must be busy and tired, I imagine.
Yeah, some unusual hours I'm keeping at the moment, yeah.
What have been the highlights so far? Obviously, Argentina losing to Colombia.
Yeah, and that was, you know, the first half of that game is possibly one of the worst games of football I've ever seen. It was possibly everything that's kind of good and bad about South American football at the same time. Lots of misplaced passes, the pitch wasn't that good, lots and lots and lots of fouls. Colombia were very, very aggressive. But in the second half, I think Colombia worked out that they didn't need to kick Argentina that much, that actually if they tried to play them at football, they'd probably beat them. And that was pretty much the story of the game. And actually 2-0, maybe even flattered Argentina in the end.
Was the game first half worse than Everton versus Leicester, which I think was a midday kickoff on Boxing Day last Christmas? The worst game of football, even worse than Cambridge-Cheltenham in the LDV Vans that I get flashbacks.
I have to say, I was in Brazil, actually, funnily enough, on Boxing Day, so I wasn't really across Everton versus Leicester.
Well, it's forgivable, and you're very lucky. Two good finishes as well. Roger Martinez is the opening goal for Colombia is worth checking out. Michael Jokin writing, this is Leo Messi's only second Copa America defeat, the first against Brazil in the 2007 final.
Yeah, because they keep losing finals on penalties at the moment, but they look like a constant mess. And I keep wanting to say that they're coming into the tournament in disarray, but I kind of think disarray is their level now. That's normal for them. And yeah, they look, I mean, I was watching, you know, they're playing like Sergio Aguero up front, and I honestly forgot he was playing for about 60 minutes of the game. Just all of these pretty decent players who just don't perform for them.
That is strange, isn't it?
It's so strange.
It's so top heavy. They've got so many talented players. Brazil beat Bolivia 3-0. Pretty straightforward win?
Yeah, pretty much. Slightly antsy crowd in Sao Paulo. They were booed off at halftime. You know, the Brazilian public, a kind of distance has grown between the Brazilian public and their team because they don't play in Brazil really anymore. And so a slightly kind of fed up, bored crowd. But yeah, absolutely routine.
We talked a little bit about the Women's World Cup and how there are some cities in France where you wouldn't necessarily know it was happening. I think it depends on the size of the city. The small cities, there's much more of a buzz about it, or it's much more noticeable. But I don't know what the reaction in Brazil is.
So somewhere like Sao Paulo or Rio, there's not a great buzz. There's not a great relationship with the team. Their next game's up in Salvador in the northeast, and there's much more of a buzz in places like that. They seem much more connected. And Dani Alves spoke about this afterwards, and he kind of said, look, that's what the Sao Paulo crowd's like. We'll play in Salvador. And he's from Bahia in the northeast, and he said, we'll play in Salvador, and it'll be a different story.
Paraguay 2, the South American giants Qatar 2. All the goals were lots of fun. Oscar Cardozo smashed a penalty home in the fourth minute after one of those handballs that's going to make me so angry over the next rest of my life. A brilliant own goal, which was the equaliser for Qatar. 13 minutes from time, where he just headed it in.
I mean, I'm pretty sure the goalkeeper might have gotten to that. I mean, if you watch the goalkeeper, it's give or take. Yeah, he would have had a chance, but the defender, the attempted clearance off the line was not great. Mm.
Venezuela. The angle he was coming from. I mean, what else was he supposed to do? The defender. He can't turn his neck into some kind of.
Yeah,
and he had to go for it. I feel a bit protective over this defender.
Yeah, no, you might have a point, but do you think?
If he hadn't stands been there, I mean, what the goalkeeper is just going to look at him. You've got to react. You can't just stand, keep him out. You must go for it, I think.
Maybe we are guilty of sensationalising this, Lars.
Yeah, no, I mean, in the moment, maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. But I still think if he hadn't gotten involved, the goalkeeper could have cleared it.
Yes, I agree with that.
Uruguay 4, Ecuador 0, and Venezuela 0, Peru 0. How good were Uruguay?
Yeah, Uruguay looked really, really good, although Ecuador looked really, really bad, and they had a player sent off in the first half, and they had like four good goes at getting someone sent off, lots of elbows and chins before they finally nailed one. But some really, really good goals in this game, actually. A really lovely scissor kick from Cavani. And just before that, he had a back heel finish, which the goalkeeper saved. And, you know, sometimes you watch a goalkeeper save an effort like that and you think, oh, come on, just let that go in. Yeah. Such a beautiful finish.
Someone tweeted about the level of shithousery generally in the Copa America. How is it?
Yeah, it's for South American levels about normal.
Okay.
At the moment, which, you know, for a European audience, quite high.
Yeah, I mean, I still go back to the Colombians just digging up the penalty spot in the England game, which was, I mean, at the time I was not happy about it, but looking back, utterly sensational shithousery of the highest order.
Yeah, and there was a wonderful shot from the Argentina-Colombia game. I just saw a still on Twitter of the referee with the yellow card in the air and about 20 players surrounding him, and there's absolutely no way of telling who he's booking. It's just, it's like a mosh pit. It's fantastic.
All right.
I did enjoy the first goal from Nicolas Lodeiro as well, and in the sort of category of sort of fun, creative, attacking South American players who are just not quite good enough to make it at a massive club in Europe, but still delightful to watch. Lodeiro straight in there in that category.
Yeah, absolutely. And Quintero as well.
Another one.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if he could be bothered, he could be quite good, but he can't, so he'll be good occasionally.
Yeah. Whose name is on the trophy, Tim?
I think Brazil will win it because, I mean, I think they're the best team in South America at the moment, but they're under so much pressure to win it as well. Absurdly, the manager will probably lose his job if he doesn't. So I'd say don't expect fireworks from Brazil. They'll probably be quite dull and gritty, but I think they'll get it done.
It's Tony Pulis, their manager, as well.
a bit.
All right, that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll begin with Maurizio Sarri off to Juventus and Frank Lampard probably becoming the Chelsea boss. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So we all expected it to happen, but Maurizio Sarri has been named the Juventus manager, signed a three-year deal. Compensation will be paid of £5 million to Chelsea, which is better than the payoff they would have had to have given him anyway. When you think they were going to sack him, is this good for Chelsea?
I tend to think that both he's done a really good job and is slightly unfairly maligned, and that it's probably a good outcome for Chelsea that he leaves, just because he is such a staunch footballing ideologue who has his own very specific way of playing, and he's not going to budge in any sort of way. And Chelsea are now facing a season where they've lost their talismanic player in Eden Hazard. They won't be able to replace him. In fact, they won't be able to sign anyone, really. And I'm not sure if Sarri's vision of the game could ever be fully implemented with the squad Chelsea have, and if he's not willing to be flexible tactically in any way, it might be better that they get in someone else.
Marina Granovskaya said, "In talks we had following the Europa League final, Maurizio made it clear how strongly he desired to return to his native country, explaining that his reasons for wanting to return to work in Italy were significant." Do we believe this?
It didn't work out, did it? I mean, it's a funny thing when you get a Champions League place and win the Europa League, and you still, the overall feeling is that it hasn't quite worked out, and maybe he would have done even better if he had time and could have got more players who suited his style and so on. But I agree with Lars, it didn't work. I didn't think it was a strange appointment in the beginning, and it's a strange Juventus appointment in a way. And there was someone in Italy said it's the most un-Juventus appointment in their history. It's just not the way he is. It's just not Juventus. And I like they've gone for him, because he's just so, he comes out with these things. He has a strop, he's in his tracksuit and so on. They are kind of Conte. They are nice suits, Fiat, all that. They're not Maurizio Sarri. So it'd be really, really interesting to see how he goes.
I just wonder if this is the first time a manager sacked Chelsea in effect. It's weird, isn't it? It just seemed like a bad fit from the beginning. And even the Chelsea fans, you know, it's quite strange, because a lot of fans, particularly at top level clubs, really want this kind of, I want to see a philosophy, I want to see an ideology behind the play. And actually Chelsea fans don't seem, from what I can gather, don't seem that bothered about having someone that plays a particular style of football. I suppose they were reared on Mourinho, and they seem to quite like, you know, we like being organised and winning trophies and doing it that way, and that seems to be their philosophy and their style.
I think most of the people saying he couldn't have done any better, really, or criticising the sackings are not Chelsea fans, and the Chelsea fans who are going week in, week out were desperate for him to lose his job ages ago.
But I think it's both true that he couldn't have done any better and that it was a complete clash of cultures and probably not sustainable in the future. Yeah, he's finished third behind the second and third highest points total in the Premier League, right? That's fine. Winning the Europa League's pretty good. And, you know, I feel very hesitant about, like, telling the Chelsea fans how they're meant to think. Yeah. Like, this is a club who, for if you go back several years and you look at, like, the possession table in the Premier League, they're usually, like, fifth, sixth. I mean, of the top teams in the Premier League, they're comfortably the one that cares the least about keeping on to possession. They've been used to watching the team play direct football. They're used to watching the team be successful that way. And so when you have the sort of the Jorginho experience and that isn't wildly successful and it isn't what they want to watch and it's not what they pay their money to go and see, you can say that that's silly. You might think that they're being simpletons or whatever, but I think that's a very bad road to go down. I think fans are entitled to feel how they feel about this sort of thing.
What would you say the highlight of his year in England is? I mean, for me, Kepa and Caballero and the
Kepagate was spectacular,
and his rant and running, just almost leaving Wembley, was just, the whole thing was absolutely tremendous. Can anyone, any advances on that?
I mean, the kind of strop he threw in the open training session before the Europa League final was quite spectacular as well. As an Arsenal fan who was in Baku, unfortunately, that kind of gave us a little bit of false hope the day before the game. We were standing there saying, oh, wow, they've fallen apart here. And then the game happened.
But I also thought that was like, yeah, he was a bit cross in training, and you had half of the English newspaper saying Chelsea are in disarray and it's anarchy. It's like, have any of these players, people played football at any level? Like, sometimes your coach is going to be a bit annoyed. Like, it happens. It doesn't mean the club is about to, like, collapse and fall down.
Marcus, you say you're surprised that Juventus have gone for him. How well do you think he'll do? And does he have a Jorginho, or does Jorginho just come along with him in like a little carry case?
I probably don't know enough about the Juventus midfield at the moment to say whether there is a Jorginho, but I think it's a weird one because almost like Bayern Munich, like PSG, he walks into a job where he's expected to win the title. He will win the title, surely. Unless Napoli do something extraordinary over the summer. And then it's all down to the Champions League. Will he win the Champions League with Ronaldo another year old? I don't think so. And so it's a weird one. You win the league, but it's not enough. So what are you going to do? And then do you leave? It's a strange situation in several countries now.
And I think you touched upon it being a strange cultural match for Juventus. I think in a sporting sense, he's a strange match for that team as well. Because again, I'm sorry to harp on about this, but he is really fanatical about playing football the way he wants it to be played. Like, there's no flex at all with him tactically. And Juventus have a team, like, they've invested all this money in Cristiano Ronaldo. Like, however you play, it's going to be all about getting the best out of Ronaldo. And I don't know. I'm not sure he will necessarily set up his team to get the best out of Ronaldo. And you say they will definitely win the league. I don't know. Like with Inter, with Antonio Conte coming in and them spending a bit of money, maybe we'll have an exciting Serie A season next year.
Now, Frank Lampard is 20-1 on to get the Chelsea job. He almost certainly will have it at some point after we finish recording. If you were Granovskaya or whoever makes this decision, who would you hire as the Chelsea manager, Tim? In thinking that you want them to be successful, not from an Arsenal fan's perspective.
I was going to say, from an Arsenal fan's perspective, maybe Frank Lampard. That's a really good question, actually. I mean, who haven't Chelsea already had? And this is the thing about Frank Lampard as well. If I were him, I wouldn't take this just because I don't think he's quite ready. And it's not like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The Chelsea job comes up pretty much every year.
So Frank, and you can come back. He could fail and still have another go.
True. So, you know, it's a little bit, well, maybe if I hold on two summers when it's up, you know, when another two managers have been and I've had another 2 years. I mean, who else is there, really?
So he's 20-1 on Benitez, second favourite.
I mean, another popular appointment.
Mourinho, next favourite. Eric Ten Hag, Allegri. Santo, all about the same. Then Simeone, Howe, Gracia, Blanc.
I guess Allegri. And Allegri, I think, possibly is a better fit for Chelsea as well. Certainly better than Sarri.
I mean, I don't see why he would ever take it. But if they could convince him to do it, he would be the sort of a tactical pragmatist they might need to guide them through the rocky waters ahead. I mean, the transfer ban, as far as I'm aware, is still a thing that's happening, right, Marcus?
It should be, yeah.
Right, so that is the other side of it for Lampard. I see how it's a tricky time to take over. It's early for him, but this surely next season will be the lowest level of expectation at Chelsea since Abramovich came in, no? Because no one in their right mind will expect him to win the league. Like, is it Liverpool and Man City are amazing and there's nothing to suggest they're going to get any worse over the summer. Chelsea have lost their most important player. They don't have the ability to replace him. They have to...
But they might just forget all of these things.
Well, this is Chelsea. It's I think it was once referred to as the ever-exploding clown car of football. It has occasionally been that. But listen, surely they realise that next season, just retaining a top four spot or doing almost as well as Sarri did will be the high watermark next year. And you have to do it by maybe finding some use out of someone from the loan army, maybe using some young players. I mean, for once, the expectations are at a pretty rational level. So, I mean, that could be an upside for Lampard if he takes it, I'm thinking.
And also, I guess another question is he bringing Jody Morris with him? Because if they've got a dip into their, you know, their academy, and we know they've got really good players, they just haven't been willing to blood yet. If they get Jody Morris to go with him, who knows those players really well, I think that potentially maybe sweetens the deal.
It almost makes it feel much more acceptable, much more sensible, even a decision, really, I think. And
far be it from me to advocate putting sort of inexperienced big names in big jobs. It's something I think we do too much in this country. I'm not a fan of it at all, but Chelsea are going to have a painful sort of rebuild situation now. It's going to be really difficult. Why not give someone like Frank Lampard a chance? Because you could spend massive big money on a big name manager to come in. Like, it's going to be tricky next season no matter what happens.
Slaven Bilic has got the West Ham job. He's had that before. Slaven Bilic has got the West Brom job, replacing Darren Moore, who was sacked in March. He's been given a 2-year contract. Is this a good move? What sort of move is this?
I think it's a disappointing move from a kind of West Brom and general point of view. It's a name move, it seems to me. I've never interviewed him. I met him once, but I've never listen to him, what he can bring. But it's not like, I think for the other side of the scale is the Graham Potter Swansea appointment last season, and it was left field, and that paid off. And then Lampard is a bit left field as well, and I think sometimes you've got to go for it. Chelsea tried the Italian experiment twice at least, and it didn't work. And West Brom is not as bad as Pardew, but it's not exciting.
Okay, I like how you define that's the lowest bar, is it?
Terrible.
I mean, I guess I kind of wish he'd stay unemployed for a while, because he's really good on TV. Like, I want more of Bilic as a pundit.
Yeah.
Because he's a proper loose cannon when he's in the studio. And you can see he makes even the other pundits slightly on edge, because he'll come out with unexpected things. He was in the studio for an international once. I think it was between Italy and Croatia that got stopped because of crowd trouble. And I'm pretty sure he started explaining to the others, like, how you smuggle flares into the ground and stuff. And you can see people very worried in the studio about the direction the conversation.
What did he say? Like, extra big pockets? Where does he put them?
I don't remember that detail.
Okay.
Strap them to your children.
Yeah, something like this, yeah. Have a slightly robust wife.
Slaven Bilic wants to bring back Dwight Gayle, who they weren't going to... they were cooling their interest because they don't want to pay Premier League contracts until they're back in the Premier League. That's what their technical director, Luke Dowling, said. But Bilic wants Gayle, so he'll probably... Well, he'll try and get him. Paul Pogba news over the weekend. He was in Tokyo on a very muffled recording on a phone, but being interviewed, saying, "I'm thinking to have a new challenge somewhere else. For me, I've been at Man United for 3 years. I've been doing great. Some good moments, some bad moments, like everybody. After this season and everything that's happened, with my season being my best season as well, I think for me it could be a good time to have a new challenge." Marcus, your thoughts?
Sell him now. Take the money and rebuild. It hasn't gone well, and it's only going to get worse. So time to sell.
Yeah, I feel like very often when we talk about Paul Pogba, it sort of descends into this sort of weird culture war where you have like the old fogies who are very worried about his hairstyle and him faffing about too much on the one hand, and you have the sort of slightly younger types, which I might be in that category, who sort of maybe defend him too much just because all the stuff Souness comes out with is unreasonable and stupid a lot of the time. But even I, as one of his longtime defenders, like, there was this run towards the end of the season when United were just terrible and they looked very tired or whatever was going on. on, and he just offered absolutely nothing. When nothing was going on with the team, when nothing was working, he's their big star, he's the big name, he's on the big contract, he wants to be the centre of everything, he finally has a manager who believes in him and will give him whatever he wants on the pitch, and he offered nothing. Like, I mean, if he wants to be the big man, you've got to offer more, and he just isn't doing it.
Is anyone surprised that Zidane sees him as the answer? I mean, that's what I would be, you know, after the 3 years he's had, where he's clearly good but not great.
But then perhaps contrary to what I just said, I suspect that in a good Real Madrid team, he'd do really well.
Well, that's I can't resist looking at this through a bit of an Arsenal lens. Like, Pogba reminds me a little bit of Ozil in terms of, not just because I'd really like at the moment for Mesut Ozil to give a muffled phone recording where he says he'd like to leave Arsenal, but I think Pogba is not a guy you drop into a team that's building. I think you drop him into a complete team, a bit like Ozil, and, you know, and you get a really, really good player. I'm not sure Real Madrid is that team at the moment, to be quite honest with you. They seem like they're building something at the moment. I feel like Pogba is like the final piece you drop into a team rather than someone you build around.
But surely, like, where else is he meant to go? Like, back to Juventus... If they could afford it, maybe they can, I'm not quite sure. Then again, he'd be an odd fit for the Sarri ball as well, I think.
And they've got Ramsey now.
Obviously.
Well, we shall see. Who do Man United get if they...
Sean Longstaff.
Do you think?
It's an option. And I kind of like the kind of Daniel James policy.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like them.
Wan-Bissaka is utterly brilliant if they get him. It's a great signing and so on, but... They got to realize that this squad is in absolute disarray, to use disarray again. But they need a rebuild, and the stars that are not producing, time to sell. But get a few homegrown players in, build that way, and try that. They're all good, exciting players.
The European Under 21 Championship started yesterday. If you needed some more football, Poland beat Belgium 3-2. Italy beat Spain 3-1. England start on Tuesday against France. You mentioned Wan-Bissaka, he's there. Phil Foden as well. James Maddison, Moise Kean for Italy. Pablo Fornells for Spain, just signed for West Ham. He's 23. But it's how old you were when the qualification began, which is
sensible, isn't it?
It seems ridiculous.
No, but it has, like, if not, then you would qualify with one team, and then a bunch of them would suddenly become overage, and you'd have to take another group.
I like the idea that if your birthday happens during the tournament, you then have to leave.
I mean, that would be a thing that would actually happen, and it would be very stupid.
Almost like a Logan's Run scenario. You get offed on your 21st birthday, and that's it.
Luka Jovic will be there as well. And Yanis Hadji, son of Georgie, playing for Romania, if you want to feel old. Ukraine won the Under 20 World Cup, beating Italy 1-0 in the final. They weren't even at the tournament in 2017, which England won. We weren't there because we lost the playoff to Norway. You bastards, Lars.
What can you do?
Wales, Ryan Giggs under pressure. This was in the Mail on Sunday. He faces a dressing room rebellion, Marcus. Defeats by Croatia and Hungary. Apparently, 10 of the squad who reached Euro 2016 under Chris Coleman are particularly concerned. It's almost like they did a survey, didn't they? How concerned are you? One is extremely, three particularly, five not at all.
It's a bit about expectations as well, and you play Croatia away and you lose fairly narrowly and so on, and I think they are probably maybe at a Hungary level, and especially with Bale not playing that well and Ramsey injured and so on, and it's, I don't know who is going to come in and transform a team with those players.
Kilmarnock have appointed Angelo Alessio, the former assistant to Antonio Conte at Chelsea, Juve and Italy, as the club's new manager. He's going to succeed Steve Clarke on a 3-year deal. Good luck to him. Fun rumours time. Diop, West Ham to Manchester United. Thoughts? Yes or no? No.
No.
No. Trippier, Juventus, 45 million.
What? No way.
I know, amazing, eh?
No. Is the source of that rumour a Mr. D. Levy?
David Neres, Ajax to Everton. I could do this one.
He's likely, I think. He's quite good.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe he should go somewhere else.
And well, he's starting for Brazil in this World Cup, Copa America in place of Neymar. So maybe his price will go up in the next few games.
I thought he might do better than Everton. You know, wants to do better than seventh, doesn't he? Carabao news, Lars.
Yeah.
What's happened?
I'm excited to read on the EFL website that draws have been the details around the first round of the Carabao Cup draw has been published.
Oh, good.
And I will read from this now because I think this is the big one. We're all looking forward to this. Often unique and unpredictable, the Carabao Cup continues to fly the competition's flag across the globe as teams discover their fate in draws held worldwide. From Bangkok to Ho Chi Minh City, the 2019-20 Round 1 draw now stops at a popular London supermarket chain. Live from Morrison's, Colindale, at 7 p.m. on Thursday the 20th of June. The draw will take place within a short distance from Wembley Stadium.
That's not good enough. Short distance from Wembley? That's amazing.
So from Bangkok to Ho Chi Minh to Colindale. And it's got a big photo of John Barnes holding a shopping trolley full of Carabao and the Carabao Cup outside of Morrison's. Now, I have to say, John Barnes, you mustn't drink all of that Carabao. It will be very bad for your innards. Like, one can of Carabao is fine, but there's just too much here.
Just so you know, a 16-minute drive from Morrison's in Colindale to Wembley Stadium. By public transport, 42 minutes. You've got to take, well, the 204 you can take all the way there. And it is a 1-hour and 9-minute walk.
If John Barnes drinks all that Carabao, he might be able to run it in about 3.5 minutes.
It's true, but the Morrison's in Colindale has a 4.2 rating on Google reviews.
Oh, does it?
Is that 1,488 people have reviewed the Morrison? I wonder what drives you to write a review online of the Morrison's in Colindale. Well, I mean, that's...
Especially if you've just had a perfectly good... If you've had a 4 out of 5 experience, yeah. You know, that was as I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
Those Google reviews are ridiculous, though, aren't they? They're always above 4.
I mean, no, there's someone here giving it a 1-star.
No, but the average.
The average.
Yeah.
It's always... I try to look up a restaurant and all the Google reviews come in. They're all above 4 out of 5. It's impossible.
What happened for the 1-star review? Like?
Someone's had an appallingly bad experience at the party counter.
At the party counter?
Yes.
What's this? I mean, what sort of Morrison's has a party counter?
The one in Colindale, I suppose.
Wow.
I won't be in a rush to go near the party counter again, says Poppy Veal.
Here we are. So. I stood there for no less than 15 minutes to ask a question, and when I finally got an answer, I was laughed at. That is, I then decided to buy a hamper. Why would you do that? Me and my partner were stood there for 20 minutes. We both went off separately and paid for our other shopping. Not once did anyone at the counter say, I will be with you in a moment. When I caught someone's eye and said hello, I was again ignored. Finally, after 20 minutes of waiting, I was finally spoken to. I was told that I couldn't buy the hamper because they had no idea how to put it through the till. I am really disgusted with this service and certainly won't be in a rush to go near the party counter again.
Does this bode badly for the draw itself? You know, I've got no idea how to take the balls out, I'm afraid. Sorry.
Well, let's hope they use, you know, there must be a deli or they could just
be,
you know,
different. Don't have the draw near the party counter.
What if they have
those guys have no idea what's going on?
If they have the draw in the bagging area and as they take it out, they'll be like, you need to please replace the ball in the bagging area, otherwise the weight will change. Listen, that's enough.
Tried buying a cider with an Australian driver's license and been rejected.
Is that a 1-star?
Yes.
Right-o. Just for some balance, this is from Carl. Nice place to shop and have a snack. So there we are. 5 stars.
So I think the Morrison's canteen is actually pretty good value.
Five stars.
I don't know about the one in Colindale specifically, but there's to one.
So many places you could have a snack. Why?
I don't know, maybe
and
not
then
in
give
Colindale.
It 5 stars. I mean, what do you
this
have?
Is the bench? This is the absolute peak of snacks.
But what Marcus, is needed? What do you know about the snacking scene in Colindale?
Not
really?
Enough, clearly. I will go there. Bad. Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe.
Anyway, that'll do for today. Marcus, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lars.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Tim.
My pleasure.
Back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.